This is Don Hussig with Cancer Action Network. You're listening to Loving the Earth, Pollution Free Rising. And today we have a very special guest. It is Dr. Paul Winchester. He is a neonatologist. He has a practice at St. Francis Hospital in Indianapolis, Indiana. And he also is affiliated with the University of Indiana. He not only does all of this large amount of work, with all these very sick, very young children. He also does his own research, which has made use of what he has experienced with his medical practice. Good morning, Dr. Winchester.
Good morning, Don.
Well, thank you so very much for being with us. Can you just give us a little more of the, your background and just introduce yourself a little more fully?
Yes, I'm actually a clinical professor at Indiana University School of Medicine, and one of the neonatologists on the faculty. And as a clinical professor, my primary duty is to direct the care of premature babies, usually, or babies with birth defects, babies who require special care. In the course of doing this for coming up to 30 years, I became interested in why the epidemic of premature birth is occurring in the country, as well as an apparent change in the distribution of birth defects. And so this led us to do large-scale population-level studies of when babies with problems such as prematurity birth defects are conceived, and correlating those dates of conception with the regional differences in time, seasonal differences in contaminants in our water supplies, primarily. The Midwest turns out to be not unique, but at least has a very dramatic difference in the concentration of contaminants in the water in the months of April through July, peaking in June. Each year, with pesticides and nitrates being the prime contaminants. And these substances are so dramatically higher in our water sources, and it turns out our drinking water, that it would be easy enough for us to ask the question, you know, if a mother conceived in those months, would she be more likely to have a birth defect, for instance? Starting with the state of Indiana, then collaborating with Illinois, and eventually doing the entire nation, and in collaboration with the water data from the U.S. Geological Survey, we recently published a summary of our work, which demonstrates that there is a significant increase in the risk of having a child with birth defects if a mother conceives between the months of April and July, and these months correlate with the dramatically with the peak incidence of pesticides in the water supply.
What are some of those pesticides, the names of some of the chemicals that are peaking in the early summer months in the water supplies of Indiana and the rest of the country?
Well, in our paper, we focused on two categories of pesticides. The most commonly found and most commonly used pesticides in America are still herbicides, and the most commonly used herbicide and the most commonly found herbicide was atrazine. So wherever atrazine was found, we also found other pesticides, and many of them are also herbicides. Glyphosate, 2,4-D, methoxychlor, and so on. There's the list of pesticides really is much longer than two screenfuls, and by no means are all of them found everywhere, but virtually every single water source sampled in the entire nation was found to have at least measurable levels of atrazine, for instance.
I see.
And this is also true for nitrates, which are found in every water supply, and it's just a matter of whether there are more or less of them. But to be fair, we don't have as much information yet on it, but we know that the water supply contains many other contaminants as well. The PCBs, dioxins, et cetera. And so as in the water, we now know that so too do we find in all humans, virtually all of these contaminants in measurable quantities. There are virtually no Americans that don't have DDT, PCBs, dioxins, flame retardants, and pesticides in their bodies at any given time. So, in terms of how this relates to cancer, we have not done research to show that our work directly links to cancer, but our work has led us to the fundamental mechanisms of how the body responds to these exposures to contaminants, and what we discover is that mechanism is actually linked, as are these contaminants, linked to most of the diseases that are currently epidemic worldwide, and among those is cancer. So in a sense, we find that we really strongly suspect now is that cancer, adult diseases like hypertension, cholesterol, diabetes, obesity, birth defects, sudden infant death, low academic achievement scores, all of them have now been linked to fetal exposures to contaminants.
Tell me, when you say that, give us a little of a detail, some of the scientific detail of what is actually taking place in the mother's body, in the, you know, the fetus, that predisposes this new organism, once it becomes a separate individual, you know, living its own life. What leads that organism to be predisposed to a higher susceptibility for certain chronic diseases, these ones that you have named?
Okay. So to start with, let's reiterate that it's certainly the genetic profile, the genome, if you will, that you receive from your parents is still a very powerful dictator of your predisposing conditions, your height, your weight, your intellect, and so on. What we didn't realize is how the fetal environment can change the way those genes that you receive from your parents could be expressed. It's as if your parents gave the recipe for brownies, but the actual volume of ingredients and the timing of their mixing is really determined by a whole other set of signals in the DNA complex. And these new signals are now referred to as the epigenome, the markers on that regulate when a gene is turned on and off.
Okay.
And the best way to summarize all of that is to describe a single experiment that was first done by Michael Skinner at the University of Washington in Pullman, who by far has been the greatest revolutionary scientist in the last decade to show us how chemicals can be altering us. The short version of this is that he has demonstrated that chemical exposure in utero can alter your risk later in life for diseases, and that these diseases might then become heritable. And to summarize that, imagine taking a pregnant rat and exposing her for just a week to one pesticide. In the case of his experiments, methoxychlor or vinclozoline were used because they're both known to be endocrine disruptors. And the timing of his experiment, 8 to 14 weeks or 14 days post-conception, corresponds to about the same time in weeks in humans, is a critical time he chose because it's when the male and the female turn into their respective types. So it's the sexual differentiation, critical time period, early pregnancy. After the exposure, which was actually done through intraperitoneal injection and therefore as some of his critics would point out, at doses that we don't usually encounter in the environment, and I think that they miss the point. These rat pups, when they're examined at birth, look entirely normal. They have no birth defects, they're not small for dates, they're not premature. And in fact, by all standards of current safety practice, an exposure of these mother rats to vinclozoline for 1 week at very high doses appears to have no toxicity whatsoever and would have been given a pass. Fortunately for him, Mike Skinner's lab is open to discovery through serendipity, and in that process, these rats were allowed to age, and what he found was that 90% of the males ended up as adults with diseases. 90% of them had new problems that the unexposed rats did not have. These problems included low sperm counts, in some cases to the extreme of infertility. They included cancer. They included kidney problems, prostate problems, problems with the immune system. They included accelerated aging. They included high cholesterol. After reviewing the phenotype these descendants who looked completely normal at birth, we could say that 90% of them, not until they became adults, were victims of diseases that ranged from cancer to high cholesterol. So this is how cancer becomes a relevant part of the story.
Yes.
The worst part of the experiment, however, was yet to come. These male rats, despite their low sperm count, were allowed to breed to uncontaminated, unexposed females, and they were allowed to have one, two, and three successive generations of offspring. And in all three generations afterwards, 90% of the males continued to have the diseases as adults, just as their parent had.
Shocking.
Except none of them had been exposed. So he had created two things in one. He had confirmed what we have already observed occurs in humans, that led to the proposal that adult diseases have fetal origins. And this was first postulated by a man named Barker and is referred to as the fetal origins hypothesis. Now, Mike has gone further with this, Dr. Skinner, and shown that accompanying these changes in the descendants of a mother rat exposed to one pesticide for 1 week, he was able to find molecular markers on DNA distributed across the genome. Up to 200 sites have now had attached to them a methyl group. These methyl groups are just single carbon atoms, but they're attached to specific regions of DNA which appear to have the ability to change the way the genes are expressed. So this gets into the recipe, the gene is the ingredient for brownies, the flour, the sugar, or the eggs. But the regulator tells the organism how much to put in and when. And these DNA methylation events are regulators. In most cases, the regulation reduces the amount of gene expressed. Only 10% of the genes actually go up in amounts after DNA methylation. But if you can imagine something on the order of 1,500 genes, or maybe thousands of genes, being changed in their rate of expression starting in the fetal life and going on through adult life, this is how we think cells begin to develop out of control, for instance, in cancer, or through a chronic inflammatory process develop cells that can no longer be stopped. This is how many other diseases appear to occur. Now, since Michael Skinner's work, many, many other groups have found that the epigenetic markers that he's found present as a result of the exposure to pesticides also occur as a result of exposures to many, many other noxious stimuli, including alterations in diet, alterations in, you know, for instance, if you're starved in during pregnancy, this is where the original fetal hypothesis came from, exposures to plasticizers and resins like bisphenol A, exposures to arsenic, lead, exposures to even such things as poor nurturing. Mother who fails to lick and nurture her baby can alter permanently the DNA markers on her offspring. And what's really frightening about Mike Skinner's work is the breadth of the problem. In other words, it isn't wherever you find cancer, it turns out you will probably also find other diseases that look entirely different from cancer, okay, like asthma or obesity or an inordinate amount of preterm birth, for instance, or male genital abnormalities, or high cholesterol, or problems with the kidneys and bladder, prostate cancer, etc. And so we think that the work that we're doing, and we have now linked the time of, if you will, the time of exposure in pregnancy to these aftermaths, if you will. In my case, the short range picture is that birth defects are more likely from exposure at the time of conception. And notice that in Mike Skinner's work, none of the rats had birth defects. So birth defects are actually a very rare outcome. And, you know, I have 50 million babies to count, and he doesn't have an experiment yet large enough to show that. We're just as concerned about preterm birth, which we now think is an epidemic and by far, in a way, contributes to more infant deaths and permanent disabilities than any single problem in our legacy. We have noticed a decline worldwide in sperm counts, if that sounds familiar. We've noticed an epidemic in cancers of all types, but childhood cancers as well as breast cancer and prostate cancer. We've noticed epidemics in asthma. We've noticed epidemics in obesity. And we've noticed more concerning things like autism and ADHD, perhaps declining academic scores and behavioral problems, etc. It is very likely now that virtually all of those diseases will have been linked eventually to these same mechanisms. Now, this isn't to say that the only cause for all these diseases is epigenetics, but
exactly.
By far and away the biggest environmental contributor to them may be epigenetics. Even such things as Alzheimer's now have been linked to developmental or childhood exposure to things like lead, which we now have proven. Dr. Deborah Lahiri from Indiana University School of Medicine shows that DNA imprinting changes the very ApoE proteins that are linked to Alzheimer's. So the disease doesn't begin until you're 50 or so, but the imprint was left by the time you were 3 to 5 years old.
And could you, what was the name of that researcher one more time?
Well, I'll have to, Dr. Lahiri.
All right. Okay.
Yeah. Well.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sure people can figure that out.
Yeah.
It's very interesting to me. My dad has Alzheimer's. And
yeah.
I had always thought that I was aware of this role of pollutants in imposing, you know, increased risk for Alzheimer's, but I was only thinking about his lifetime, you know, his individual lifetime.
His own exposure, yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. He had done a lot of scraping on a house, a very large house, covered with lead paint. He was a real perfectionist, and he just breathed a large amount of this lead dust. Mm-hmm. And he also worked in an apple orchard using arsenic of lead. And they would just eat the apples.
Yeah.
They would eat the apples just without any carefulness, no washing the apples, just pick them up off the ground and eat them. So he had a lot of lead exposure, and I, you know, thought about, you know, the fact that he was probably likely to get Alzheimer's. That was kind of the cause of it, you know. And you look for a cause, you know, everybody wants to know why horrible diseases come along. And now you're telling me this, you know, just another part of the story.
Well, and I think that the point here is that we have just been sort of childlike in our assessment of risk. You know, the first things that we guarded against and protected ourselves against were things, I like to use the example of fire. You know, we learned, you know, in ancient times, fire was a very scary thing. And if you put your hand in it, you burned yourself. So we learned to stay, you know, a certain distance from the fire. We lived with fire, but we knew that there were certain things you couldn't do with it. Otherwise, you were going to get burned or hit or hurt. But it never occurred to us that if we live in a small hut where there's a fire burning all the time, over time, the smoke from the fire is going to damage our lungs. And a good example of that is tobacco, where, you know, when you smoke a cigarette at age 15, you may cough a little bit, but you don't die. You don't die of cancer the next day or emphysema. But you do by the time you're 50. You have heart attacks and cancer, et cetera. We didn't know that there was a direct link between tobacco use and those later onset diseases. We didn't know it for many years. Now we do know it. We also didn't know that when you expose a fetus to tobacco smoke, that it can cause DNA methylation and alter the lifetime risk of that baby of being obese and having diabetes and other things. Now we can assess. We knew that these babies were smaller, more likely to be premature, et cetera, et cetera. We just didn't fully grasp it.
Okay.
So now we have a way of linking through Mike Skinner's work an even longer scale concern. It turns out it's your great-grandmother's exposure to, in my grandmother's case, sheep dip and pesticides on the ranch that could have conferred risk to her offspring and their descendants. This means that the exposure that we think is safe today has far-reaching implications if we're not careful.
Yes. Just to kind of restate and to make it very, very clear for the listeners who are not scientists, at least many of them are not, describe a little more this whole matter. You speak of the methylation. So it is, just let me kind of put it in my words and then we'll see if this is right. Basically, the endocrine disrupting chemical, the contaminant, the chemical like these pesticides, like you named the atrazine and the methoxychloris, some pollutant is in the body of the mother, and it causes these methyl groups to be added at certain places in the genome of the offspring.
Well, it may be added or subtracted. In many cases, the effect appears to be subtraction of methyl groups. So ironically, and we're not sure why, but when the bisphenol A, the resin that is in plastics to make them strong, that has been receiving a lot of press, it deserves this press because bisphenol A can be found in every single baby and every single human. But when added to a mouse's diet during pregnancy, the mouse ends up with fewer methylation sites on a Goody gene. And that gene controls the lifetime risk of this offspring being obese and having yellow coat color, and perhaps being and otherwise not well. And it can be passed on to its offspring. So what pattern of methylation occurs, the disruption of that pattern, is the concern. Now, heretofore, we've always thought that a chemical acted by literally punching holes in cells and killing them, or punching holes in DNA and causing a mutation. And certainly this occurs, but we had no idea that well below the so-called lethal level or lethal dose of these drugs and exposures, that these contaminants are behaving as molecular signals. In fact, in many cases, the signaling characteristic of these molecules is greatest, not at the highest doses, but at the lowest doses. In fact, they don't really have the same effect at all at high doses. So our whole model of toxicity was based on the assumption that, that if you add a little bit more, and when you reach the level of, you know, death, then that's the highest level you can take. And every level below that is presumably safer. That doesn't turn out to be true.
Right.
And in fact, with phthalates, another plasticizer found in all members of society, it's the lowest doses that seem to have the greatest effects. Now, when you think about hormones, we know that one of the most cancer-causing things there is a hormonal stimulation to cell growth. And so imagine these hormonal stimuli starting in utero on target organs like the prostate and breast, and we can show that the breast and the prostate are significantly altered in the fetus by the exposure to very small quantities of atrazine or bisphenol A or phthalates. And it's really no wonder that they eventually develop cell growth patterns that are out of control. But now, for instance, when you develop testicular cancer, we really have to go back to the exposures that your mother had. We can predict it better from what went on during her pregnancy with you, which is frightening. We're making observations now. Dr. Hugo Ochoa Cunha from Purdue has been able to look at satellite images of where you live when you conceived your child and making predictions about whether your child will have club feet or not. The closer you are to a cornfield, the more likely you are. Now that's pretty big stuff.
Yeah, speaking of being close to cornfields, when I grew up, we were on a farm in a township of Lisbon, New York, up in the northern part of New York State, and we had farmers for neighbors, and we even used the atrazine ourselves. We used it on our cornfields for the cattle, but we didn't use it on the cornfield for us. You know, we were a little careful of it to that extent, not careful enough. It's a very kind of gravelly soil, and everything just goes right down into the groundwater. And so it actually came to the point where I had begun to be more concerned about the herbicide use, and our neighbors hadn't. And they plowed this land, and they were going to plant corn there. And they always spray before, or shortly after, I guess, sometimes after the planting. Anyways, I talked to this neighbor and asked him if he would consider just not spraying quite right up to the fence line, you know, maybe to cultivate the corn that was near our property boundary line, because our well, dug well, was only about 20 yards from the edge of this cornfield. And sure enough, I came back. I wasn't there all the time, and they sprayed right to the boundary, and it was kind of a falling out amongst neighbors for sure. But I to think that these chemicals, certainly in this area, this St. Lawrence County, this north part of New York State.
Well, you're describing a scenario identical to mine right now.
Hmm.
This has actually happened to me while I watched it happen last year.
Hmm.
My well sits on the border of a cornfield. My green lawn was partly killed by the atrazine sprayed into my yard, killed part of half of one tree as well. I was standing in the treehouse looking at it happen, and of course got sprayed myself.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at a graph right now of testicular cancer risks based on mother's contaminant levels, and this is a pretty depressing list of PCBs, pesticides like DDT, which perhaps another notion that people should be concerned about is, even if you decide that a molecule is, when you finally decide that it needs to be banned, like DDT or PCBs, these were banned in the late 1970s, 1976. They're still found in every single human, and they're still correlated with disease.
Yeah.
I'm looking at a graph of childhood cancer rates based on the percent of cropland that they live near, and the odds of having cancer markedly increases with whether you go from less than 20% cropland to greater than 60% cropland. In almost every case, the more crops are near you, the more likely you are to have, and I have a list of 50 cancers here that all seem to be correlated with cropland.
Well, it's so frustrating because, you know, say a person's concerned. I had a certain level of concern about the atrazine, but then I looked at some of the scientific literature. Maybe I may have, and I don't remember if I did or not, but I may have contacted, say, New York State DEC or some regulatory entity. And it always seems, and certainly if that wasn't the case with that particular chemical, it has been the case over and over again with my experience, mm-hmm. say, concern about dioxins or concern about the PBDEs or concern about bisphenol A. It has always been the case that the government regulatory entities have always taken the position that the amount of exposure is safe.
You know, yeah.
Make this claim over and over again,
yeah.
and yet it appears clear from what you're stating and what, you know, I have come to experience too.
We call it an industry-friendly position.
Pardon me?
We call it an industry-friendly position.
Yeah, that sounds about right. So
now,
it
goes beyond that. The EPA, for instance, in my research, contributed information for my work. I was able to get really the best quality measurements, the most unpolitical measured measurements that are out there from the U.S. Geological Survey, who was allowed to measure water from watersheds that ultimately supply 70% of America's water. Now, you mentioned well water, and, you know, 30% of Americans get water from wells, and many of these wells are contaminated without knowledge because we don't have an overarching rule to check everyone's well. And when you do ask to have them check, they won't check for the things you want them to check for. What we discovered was that the federal law that is being, if you will, enforced by the EPA allows water companies to measure the water only four times in an entire year. Now, if you were looking at the graph that I'm looking at with this massive peak in pesticides in May and June, imagine not having to measure in June, ever. That's what the current law allows. So they don't ever measure the peak month of contamination. They measure only four times in the year, and they get to average all of those four measurements before they are held accountable, as if to say that the measurement, you know, the peak level that you experienced in June didn't happen. And, of course, this means that we assume that you can't be made, that the toxicity has no relevance to mother's first trimester, for instance, which lasts only 2 months, and so we are grossly underprepared when it comes to the federal regulations. Now, these regulations were written by industry for legislators, and they're clearly not designed to protect the public. They're designed to make the paperwork minimal. So we have a kind of an uphill battle when it comes to our federal agencies, you might be surprised at how much concern there is in the public. For instance, all the farm and grow, you know, fruit growers of America are almost all using chemicals on their products, and they will resist to the death the removal of those chemicals from their arsenal. So we really need to assist them in coming up with a plan that allows them to still make, you know, to have the productivity that they have, and perhaps use either safer or no chemicals. And in the meantime, they represent as constituents a very powerful lobby against those who are more concerned about the outcomes. While we're on the subject of breadth of disease, you know, I'm looking at another graph. I've just shown you or described to you the cancer rates as they're related to fetal exposure to pesticides. You've already mentioned your father's Alzheimer's disease, and I now have work with Dr. Lahiri that suggests that early lead exposure contributes to that. Parkinson's disease is another disease that we think now is related to pesticide exposure. But who knew that depression, virtually everybody's on an antidepressant right now. Why is there an epidemic of depression?
Yep.
Well, we can link that to your lifetime exposure to pesticides as well. Mercury levels are so high now in fish, and it doesn't matter where you catch them, that we can predict the mercury levels in pregnancy by how many fish the mother eats. She's being told to eat fish for the benefits of this long-chain fatty acids, and yet she can't get the fatty acids without being contaminated by excess PCBs and mercury.
Yeah, you had mentioned to me when we first began discussing your expertise that you were planning on attending a Beyond Pesticides conference, and now that has taken place. And it's my understanding that you came upon some further publications regarding atrazine exposure and cancer risk. Can you share a little of what you learned there at the Beyond Pesticides conference?
Well, I hadn't just specifically looked at the cancer link with atrazine, I guess what I would recommend to you is a publication that we got in our paperwork,
Okay.
A report by the Land Stewardship Project and Pesticide Action Network in North America. And the Pesticide Action Network is a wonderful organization whose executive director is Catherine Gilje, G-I-L-J-E. And I suspect she could provide this information to anyone
Okay.
Who would like it. The title of it is the Syngenta Corporation and Atrazine, and perhaps would be useful. Another person to work with is Carolyn Cox, who's the research director for the Center for Environmental Health, and she's in Oakland, California.
Okay, and that is the State Center for Environmental Health? California Center for Environmental Health?
Well, I don't know if it's the state. It's
okay.
Okay. She has actually been someone that I have used a lot to gain further knowledge about specific chemicals. And
okay.
It's very helpful.
Well, let's talk about one more thing here. I've really gotten a lot of your time, and I hope you'll just tell me when you have to go back to the neonates. But my question is this. We've talked about this epidemic. You've used the word epidemic over and over again. I've heard that word before. Dr. Theo Colborne says that we are living in the midst of an epidemic of all these endocrine disruptor-related diseases. You know, we've seen it so powerfully in animals. We see it to a considerable extent in humans, considering your research. It's not perfectly, absolutely proven beyond a shadow of a doubt. You know, the last word, every I dotted and every nail driven firmly down. But still, in reason, in caring, in precaution, in concern for the future, what can be done based on the science? You know, using the science we have right here, right now, what strong steps can be taken to change the situation that exists at this moment in time?
Well, I think that one of the conclusions that we all came to in this Beyond Pesticide group is a group of people that range from, you know, those of us who are doing the science, some of us like Michael Skinner, our molecular biologist, and have really the most cutting-edge ability to measure molecular markers on a cellular level. Others like Warren Porter are looking at the behavioral effects of fetal exposure to pesticides in a rat model in his Department of Zoology at the University of Wisconsin. Others like me are looking at babies and population scale. They're called ecological studies. They're not the same, but they suggest that what if this is happening at the Mike Skinner level, if it were happening in humans, we would find precisely what we find. The others in the room are range from educators in schools to concerned citizens. There are some people who have already launched businesses in what are referred to as the alternative, sensing that sooner or later the public is going to realize that they must begin to ask for organic pesticide-free produce. They must demand that their schools and public buildings no longer be havens or sanctuaries for pesticides. We mustn't, we mustn't be spraying a neurotoxin in the classrooms for cockroach control. And there are people in the room that were doing that. And so it turns out that every single person has in their world an opportunity to act in some way on behalf of this new knowledge. One action is to ask for clean water and clean produce, things, pesticide-free produce, to vegetables to feed to your children. This has already been proven to be effective. To drink from containers that are bisphenol-free, this has already been shown to be efficacious in a simple experiment done at Harvard. And most importantly, to make the message of this concern resonate with legislators and public officials, because for now, as we've seen with other initiatives like healthcare, the very, very deep pockets of companies that are making, I think the last look I saw was a $14 billion industry in selling pesticides. Companies that not only make seeds that are genetically modified to resist the pesticides, but they also sell the pesticide. So we have Roundup Ready seeds. And these products encourage the use of more pesticides. They don't deter the use, they increase the use. So for now, we're in the midst of a tsunami of chemical exposures. We have produced chemicals that look on the face of it to be incredibly useful to us. Things like stain removal, stain-resistant carpets, stain-resistant furniture, and stain-resistant clothing, and fire-resistant clothing and fabrics. And now we put those molecules in virtually every product we sell. Who knew that these molecules, by being resistant to oxidation, are immortal molecules? They are now found in every life form on the planet, from porpoises to Arctic foxes. And not only that, but they act as molecules, as signaling molecules inside the cell. They're endocrine in effect. 100% of the breast milk samples in women in Indiana have flame retardants in them at levels that are 30 times higher than Europe. So our awareness of this problem is our first problem. And the second problem is to somehow begin to demand a change. We did not sign up to become toxic waste dumps, but we have, under our very noses, become one.
Yep. Do you think that people are good enough to accomplish this, considering the fact, as I've come to believe, and I'm certain that you have come to believe, that so much of our government that we've depended upon to keep the poison away from us and protect us from the chemicals that were being utilized in the economy for potentially assumedly reasonable purposes, but it still didn't turn out that way. There was very little care taken to protect the public or the environment, considering the fact that took place basically because of the great amount of influence that corporations that use chemicals and manufacture chemicals have with the policymakers, these elected representatives. How can we expect to have a change in what we've observed in the past if we don't make some revolutionary change in that matter, this matter of our representatives and the relationships they have with money?
Well, you know, you've asked a question that would be interesting to ask that question in 1859, where half of the legislators in Congress and the founding fathers were slave owners who had an economic vested interest personally, not just through their PAC funds, but they had personal vested interest in their slaves and maintaining slavery. And yet, somehow, this year, we have a president who could never have been imagined to be president in 1859.
Yep.
Now, it's true that it took a civil war to rid ourselves of slavery, but I would like to think that slavery is the worst thing we've ever had to overcome. This problem, which may be more insidious and certainly has dollar signs that are bigger, is no different than slavery. It's a problem that has happened to us without our permission. We didn't all do this through pure malevolence. We just now have become aware of it on a scale that we are now aware of it. And yes, there are lots of people who are going to oppose it. Some of them are going to oppose it vehemently, and some are going to do extraordinary things to prevent it from it being enacted. But one by one, we've been able to put restrictions on things like lead emissions and DDT and bisphenol A. We did it because we finally realized this has got to stop. This is killing us. I'm looking at a slide right now that shows all my favorite foods. Everything from peaches to strawberries to apples. I thought it was interesting that you mentioned apples. They're considered in the 12 fruits and vegetables of absolutely the worst degree of contamination. They are the dirty dozen. And almost every one of them, bell peppers, spinach, are my favorites.
Yep.
So we can change. This is not undoable, but it's going to take systematic change. And one of the exciting things is to look at what happened with bisphenol A. The government actually set up a panel to review bisphenol A. The panel was made up of stacked, if you will, by industry-friendly people, and they came out with a conclusion that was entirely inconsistent with the scientific evidence and with public welfare.
How do they dare do that?
This was fought by the scientific community, and in a sense, they won.
Right.
It was an embarrassment, but it finally happened. Just like the Supreme Court at one time ruled that it was okay to have slaves and required that they be returned to their owners, even if it was the Supreme Court, it still changed.
Yes.
And we now have a whole country, Canada, that's banned bisphenol A, a whole city, Chicago, that's banned bisphenol A, you know, and a whole state, Minnesota. So things can change as people become more aware. When Mike Skinner gave a talk in Europe last year, within months, this benclozoline was banned in Switzerland. It is worth noting that atrazine, a herbicide that I've just mentioned, is banned in all of the European Union, and yet is made by a company that's in Switzerland. The only place it's allowed now is in third world countries, you know, like America.
Yeah.
So we have, you know, we are being influenced negatively by a special interest, but this will not stand because the American people have a habit of doing the right thing, even if it takes too long and hurts too many people. We did finally ban slavery. We were the last country in the world to do it, the developed country. We're the last country in the developed country world to provide health care for our people. But we're slowly getting there. In the meantime, we you know, the as the scientific community is allowed to function and produce evidence that is overwhelming, we are going to have to act. If we don't, we will become an extinct race because our sperm counts and infertility will simply eliminate us from the equation.
So the hopeful picture is that people will become more educated, understand these matters that you've been discussing, we've been talking about, and understand that chemicals impose disease in many ways throughout our existence and even the existence of our previous, our progenitors. And then there's something that can be done about that. And do you believe that the change will come largely from just people ceasing to purchase the products that impose the exposure, that are involved in imposing the exposure? Or will it be that, we get our representatives, our policymaker representatives to take action kind of before that stage of things, and that they will also do their part?
In the final analysis, it takes public outcry.
It took
Harriet Beecher Stowe, and it took John Brown, and it finally became, in other words, a politician can't win an election unless the public, it's perceived that the public wants it. The public is the final arbitrator, and so it
are
is you.
Are you hearing any outcry?
Well, no, but one of the things that I can tell when I speak is I think when people receive the information, the knowledge. Now you could argue that the media outlets have given a pass to this problem. Do you see regularly an article that suggests that we're in the midst of an epidemic of human contamination?
Not at all.
Well, actually, if you look at Time Magazine this week, for the first time there's a big article about bisphenol A, and some quotes by Bruce Lampier that are the kind of quotes that are going to move this nation. The problem is we don't want to ever take our eye off the ball. This is not about one molecule. This is not about one disease. There are 85,000 molecules that have been released and are given a pass, and none of them are being tested against the kind of safety measures that we now know must be done. This is about changing our DNA and our descendants forever, and it's happening right under our noses.
Yeah, I feel kind of, every once in a while I'll look back and think to myself, boy, I wish I had done more back there 10 years ago when I did truly know a lot of what I could have utilized. But I really believe there's this thing, this social dynamic matter wherein one doesn't feel comfortable with taking, a certain place, a certain stand, and being really aggressively active on a particular matter. If such a large part of the rest of one's, fellow human beings aren't somewhere on that same path, and you don't feel any social support at all. And I do have to say that I feel like the general social fabric, this kind of like the thinking of the common man and, just this more widespread kind of view and position is that, there needs to be a great change with this matter of so much disease. So many people in this area talk about high cancer rates, and there are people starting to contact us and suggesting that maybe their doctor, maybe their oncologist would be someone who would go to the policymakers and help make a difference on this. And we're so excited about this whole idea of investigations. You did your investigation of this high birth defects and this unhealthy babies, these sick babies, and then found that peak of these chemicals in the drinking water at the same time as this conception of these babies.
Well, just what I found that was most concerning to me and ultimately is the relevant for all of us is when I began asking the question about birth defects, I knew that birth defects are considered the leading cause of infant death and by the CDC and have been for the last 10 years. Now, infant death is only the most important outcome of pregnancy the you could say the most important health fact of the human race. When, you know, if our babies are dying, then we have no future.
Yep.
What I found was that a full 24% of all the states in the country in 2001 did not even have a program for counting birth defects, including my state. They didn't know how many birth defects they had because they weren't counting them. So when I find out that the world's leading industrial nation is not counting the leading cause of infant death in a quarter of its population, that alarmed me. It said our national priorities are out of sync with what's real. The second part of it I found was that they're not measuring the water, the contamination of the environment, in the month when it's most contaminated. And they're permitting this by law. So when you don't count the babies and you don't measure the contaminants, you haven't found a problem.
Exactly.
And that's what they were telling me. We didn't have a problem.
Exactly.
Well, how completely bogus is that? Now, if we care about this phenomenon, we must demand that these things be done. We still have in place the contamination of wells and water supplies. We just now discovered in the New York Times released this information, but it's conveniently kept low profile, that 87% of the water supplies in all of the Midwest have atrazine in them. When did we give permission for that? I don't care if they call them safe levels. We already know that their idea of safe is sufficiently high that the majority of frogs are becoming hermaphrodite at micro levels.
Yeah.
That's not the same as safe.
Certainly not. So how was your calling out, to your representatives going? Do you have any good stories to tell us about how things have gone when you've tried to bring some of these changes in your state and at the national level as far as dealing with these policymakers?
Well, I don't have very – I haven't been very effective in that area, although I have met both at the national level and at our state level. And I'm not sure that – I'm more convinced, I think, that what appears in the newspaper is going to have more effect than if I present this information to my senator and congressman, which I've done.
Yep, we've done it too.
And I think what I realized is that, unless I have – when I go to their office and I have a giant mandate from either a group or a fat, big fat wallet, one or the other, there's no reason for them to, to pay much attention to me. I look like a single person.
Yeah, I know.
And so we, we find that they are moved more by the potential. They're elected. They have to know. They have to get a sense from the voting public that this is a big deal.
Yep.
They get that sense more from newspapers than from scientific journals. And
sure.
And when people protest in the streets and make even though they might be in the minority, they get a sense that's a constituency, a group of people that are concerned. So there are reasons to promote in the way that you are this message. The more people get the message, the more the more personal we can make it for the largest number of people. I've said that the way to really get this politically moved is to do what we did for AIDS victims years ago, is we developed a test for AIDS long before there was a cure. And so people were marching in the streets with their test. I'm positive for AIDS. Where's my cure?
Yep.
And hundreds of thousands of them marched on Washington demanding a change in priorities, and they got it. We need the same number of women with their breast milk contamination samples in their hands demanding to know how their womb and their breast milk has become a toxic waste dump.
Yep.
And what are we going to do about it? This is the scale of the problem. It is It is mind-bending.
Yep.
As Bruce Lampier said, it's not that the environment has contaminants, it's that we have them. We are the ones that are contaminated. It's in our bodies, and we're passing on our contaminant legacy, not just physically through the molecules, but now genetically, epigenetically, through the changes that they have wrought in our molecules.
So what are the logistics of getting, you know, millions of American women, you know, tested for breast milk levels?
Well, to me, this is it's like the AIDS test. Find a company that can make this test accessible. That means by price and simplicity. And if we offer it over the internet, at $50 a head or $100 a head, I think there's enough women that would pay that to do it. I'd love to have 100,000. I'd love to have 1 million women tested. You know, the only group that's actually done this is the Environmental Working Group on 10 volunteers.
Yeah.
And part of the problem is it costs so many thousands of dollars to do it.
That's the problem.
But this is what we need to do. Once, you know, I have faith in us that once we know what our problem is, we can fix it. But we are right now heavily, I call it the Monty Python trying not to be seen contest. You know, the entire National Institutes of Health spent 15 years failing to find the nation's leading weed killer in Americans. They managed not to find it, even though it is present in almost 70% of Americans. But you can do that if you just pick the wrong molecule to look for.
Yeah, and if you don't have someone like you looking over your shoulder and figuring it out, what they're doing.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, but that's almost a joke, really. You know, if it weren't true.
there's people who get it.
Yeah.
Well, I guess in the beginning, all changes come that way. There's a few people who get it, and then they start, you know, crying out and trying to raise awareness, and then more and more people start to jump on board. And hopefully this will get, you know, going pretty good sooner or later. I'm hopeful about it. I really believe that there's a good vibe right now, and that I do a lot of work with young people.
I think you need to spend a little more time telling this personal story of your father's, and there may still be time, actually, to analyze his tissue to prove that, in fact, lead and pesticides were the cause of his son.
That's an idea for sure. Well, this has been great, and I just honor you so much. Just, do you have a website? How can people get to know you better?
Well, we're not. I'm a practicing physician, so I have a web. I have a email address, paul.winchester@sistersofstfrancishospitalsouth.org, and that's SSFHS.org. But I'm not trying to promote right now. I'm not a website or blogger. I'm sitting here with my research assistant, Kathy Proctor, and we have to get going on the work of doing the research trying to get it published. It would be worth your knowing that all of the work I've done has come without any grant money. And this is another part of the story. You know, when the National Institutes of Health gives grant money out, there already are constraints on who receives the money, and some of those constraints are the kind of questions you're allowed to ask, and others are, to be peer reviewed is to also be peer influenced. I've gotten to ask these questions because I didn't ask anyone's permission.
Well, that's the best way to do it. I've heard people say, I'd rather apologize than ask permission.
Yeah.
Yep.
One of my colleagues who is dependent on grants to do work in a nearby college is working in a college that gets most of its money from companies that manufacture pesticides, and he has not been offered tenure, not been offered a chance to stay there. And this is an example of the pressures that that researchers are under.
Yep.
And therein lies the reason why the information, you know, if you just say who gets the microphone, most of the time it's the people with the biggest dollars.
That is the very heart of this experience we're having. I think it's all about people not being as good as, you know, they could be, and that they would have a much better result if they would be. Mm-hmm. A little too low yet to be playing with these chemicals as much as we do.
Well, we all would like to imagine that it's not happening to me. It's like you and your neighbor. You know, you didn't know that it was actually trickling down into the well. And once it's there, by the way, it stays there forever. It doesn't ever go away. So we have nitrate contamination of wells, and atrazine contamination of wells. I rode on an airplane back to my home state of Montana, which I've always loved to think of as this pristine, clean place. And the entire capital city's well supply had been contaminated by atrazine, and they don't have cornfields anywhere near that place. And so they were wondering where that came from. And it's just an example of how insidious it can become, that all of us are being forced to drink weed killer with every sip. I mean, come on. No, nobody needs. We don't need to discuss this. This is not worth a discussion. Don't tell me that it's safe and good.
Well, on that very, very strong, positive note, are you ready to wrap it up?
Yeah, that's it.
Thanks, Dr. Winchester.
You're
fantastic. I've been telling people about my experiences of meeting you, and I'm always saying, this guy's not human, you know. He's just like on this other, he's like, you know, this above the human level, you know. It's pretty cool.
Well, that's not true. We are just the most ordinary humans there are that can ask these ordinary human questions.
Okay. Well, have it your way. I consider you to be very tough-like.
All right.
Nice talking. Okay, day, bye.